Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Ghibliotech, the podcast that soars through the sky of films from the world's greatest animation studio, Studio Ghibli. I'm Michael Leader, and I've seen the lot of them.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I'm just along for the adventure.
So join us on our quest into the glorious world of Ghibli. Jake, welcome back to the Ghibliotech.
Oh, it's lovely to be back. It's always nice to be here.
So are you ready for this week's film?
Certainly am.
So we've taken this wayward stroll through the whole library of Studio Ghibli films this season. I think the link to last week's episode, Tales from Earthsea, was Goro Miyazaki's first film, is that this, Castle in the Sky, is Hayao Miyazaki, his father's first Studio Ghibli film. In fact, the first ever Studio Ghibli film, full stop.
Yeah, and I think this is going to be an example. This back end of the series we're on is going to be a lot of payoff, I think, for our strange way of approaching these films. Mm-hmm. Because it has been fascinating to see the impact of those heavy hitters like Spirited Away and how they would shift the studio and how those narratives would change as well. But it's going to be brilliant to now delve into how it all began.
Mm-hmm. Going very back to the start with Castle in the Sky. As always, we're going to be going quite deep into context, history, and then with your review afterwards. Up front, we'll have the synopsis of the film as well. But if you've not watched the film, there will be spoilers. If a film that's 30-odd years old can be spoiled, maybe go and watch the film, experience it for yourself first.
Yeah, I would say try and watch the film rather than re-watching the trailer or watching the trailer. I don't think the trailer that was available on YouTube is a great representation of the film. So just maybe go in blind if you can.
Go straight into the film, and we'll be waiting for you when we come back. But those who are still with us, let's take off to the castle in the sky. Legend has it that a floating island called Laputa lies just beyond the horizon, and an unlikely ensemble of characters are destined to find it. There's Pazu, the young miner whose father once caught sight of the fabled castle in the sky. Sheeta, a girl with a mysterious past and a precious necklace that points the way. The nefarious Muska and his military goons, and a ramshackle squad of sky pirates looking for a score of mythological proportions. But what will they find there?
Okay, Michael. So at this point, in terms of Studio Ghibli, there really is no context at this point. This is a complete blank page. No one knows what this studio is really going to do yet. Mm-hmm. But the main team behind it, who we know to be the core of Studio Ghibli, this is not like their first film.
This is not their first rodeo at all, Jake. No, of course, Hayao Miyazaki, Isao Takahata, by this point, had decades-long careers in animation. Most recently, we're going back to the mid-80s here, they'd had a huge hit with a film called Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind, which we'll get to eventually, which is one of these films that is pre-Ghibli but is now accepted as part of the Ghibli canon because so many of the key players are involved in it. That film is such a hit that they're able to quit their day jobs at the animation company Topcraft and strike out on their own. And on the 15th of June, 1985, they formed their own studio called Studio Ghibli. Have we actually said what Ghibli means yet?
I think we may have.
Maybe way back when, yeah. On the Spirited Away episode we did. But Ghibli is taken from a term which is means the warm Saharan winds that blow through the Mediterranean. It's also the name of an Italian World War II aircraft, Jake, yeah. If it's keeping the aircraft theme going.
I'm beginning to think
going.
They like aircrafts.
I mean, one of them at least does. But of course the theme here is that this new studio will be a new, you know, brand new, fresh, creative force that will blow through the industry and revolutionize it. And financial support in these early days comes from the publishing company Tokuma Shoten, who we've talked about before, mm-hmm. And a key player early on is the editor of one of the magazines, Animage. It's Toshio Suzuki, who'll become quite a titanic figure.
He is the MVP of these films.
He is. He's the Nick Fury in the background, yeah. putting the band together. But their goal with this new studio was to offer feature animation, not the TV animation that Miyazaki and Takahata had been famous for many years in the past. They'd cut their teeth on. And the first project would become Castle in the Sky. Now, already at this very early stage, there are multiple sources that say different things about why Castle in the Sky was their first project. One that I've seen a few refer to, I'm not sure how apocryphal it is that this project was kickstarted very quickly off the back of Nausicaa because so much of the money made off that film was funneled into personal projects, specifically a documentary that Isao Takahata was making, a live-action documentary about a canal system in the city of Yanagawa that eventually would balloon to nearly 3 hours long and was almost completely uncommercial. So they said, quick, Miyazaki, can you make like a fun animated film that can make some money back? I don't know how apocryphal that is. That film hasn't been officially released in the UK yet.
I dream of seeing that
film. I mean,
film.
We're going to have to cover it someday if it ever does. But that's the potentially apocryphal story. The official story is that Miyazaki writes this original proposal in December of 1984, at which point the possible titles for this project include Young Pazu and the Mystery of the Levitation Crystal, The Flying Empire and Flying Treasure Island. And he writes about how this was going to be a 90-minute film that will aim to be fun, intensely thrilling, classic action film. It will have laughter and tears and a sentimentally honest spirit and will also depict themes of emotional bonding and self-sacrifice, things that modern audiences are skeptical of, but without realizing it, really crave. This is a project to bring animation back to its roots. Miyazaki talks about a confluence of influences here, including good old boys' adventure stories like Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island, or, of course, Gulliver's Travels, where he gets the name Laputa from, which is one of the locations that Gulliver travels to in that book. Also, there's Jules Verne influences here, the way that this is going to be a retro-futurist adventure story with almost a steampunk vibe. So this is meant to be a big, fun adventure.
But also it has that, if he's trying to bring in a wider audience and looking at when this is made, this is just post-big hits Spielberg as well.
Exactly.
And from a Western side of thing, I think that's the influence that we're seeing in this film, or
you
vice
think
versa.
So this is very post-Indiana Jones, isn't it? Post-E.T. But I think anime at the time, again, I'm not really an expert on early 80s anime, but Miyazaki talks about a cynicism. In a similar way to what we see with comic book movies now, is the style starts to gravitate towards an older audience as the genre matures, and he sees it as being cynical and bloody and too confusing and convoluted. He wants to go back to a younger audience and be more earnest and whimsical, and that's what this project is supposed to be. And of course, part of that is capturing the magic of flight. That's a great quote here from Miyazaki saying, "Flying, like in Laputa, was my childhood dream. To recreate my childhood dreams, I created a fictional island called Laputa, a stage for sci-fi adventure." And part of this inspiration comes in 1985 when he comes to the UK, actually, for a tour, a sort of a sabbatical, a inspirational jaunt. And this is around the time where he goes to Wales, and there's just been the miners' strike in the early 1980s, which, of course, fails. And it's a very complicated time in British political history. But he writes, "I was in Wales just after the miners' strike. I really admired the way the miners' unions fought to the very end for their jobs and communities, and I wanted to reflect the strength of those communities in my film. I saw so many places with abandoned machinery, abandoned mines. The fabric of the industry was there, but no people. It made a strong impression on me, a whole industry with no people." So then that comes in with Pazu becoming a young miner and early scenes in Castle in the Sky being based in this mining community and very much a tribute to the people there. A quick word on the music. Issa Takahata is here as a full-blown producer, and Joe Hisaishi was brought back. He'd worked with them for the first time on Nausicaa. Miyazaki says that at this point in his career, he really doesn't know a single thing about music. So Takahata's main job is sorting out all the music, where it goes, what it's going to sound like. He does give Hisaishi some, like, basically three words of basic direction, which is he wants the music to capture dreams, romance, and adventure. And I think this is maybe one of Joe Hisaishi's best scores.
I would have to agree as well.
Maybe we'll get back to that in a second. But the film's released 2nd of August, 1986, and it doesn't really do as well as Nausicaa. It makes maybe two-thirds of the box office that film did. Not a great start for the new studio. And, of course, after this, they go and make the double bill that doesn't do much money with Totoro and Grave of the Fireflies.
So then we get to where we started this season with Kiki, of having to really save the whole thing.
So this is Studio Ghibli's almost stumbling start. However, Castle in the Sky becomes very slowly this cultural juggernaut. It fares really well on home video. The soundtrack becomes a bestseller. And particularly on television, it becomes this regular screening over the years, almost annual screenings that become almost appointment television for people and a highlight of the television calendar. In the years since release, it's had a huge influence on anime films, TV series, video games, particularly, I think, of Final Fantasy, the mixture of high fantasy settings, but also airships. I think of The Legend of Zelda games, Super Mario Brothers, Sonic the Hedgehog. You can see almost little seeds of Castle in the Sky in all of these game series. And then, you know, it's a favorite of many anime fans. It regularly tops or comes quite high in popular polls of the best anime films of all time. Mamoru Oshii, the creator of Ghost in the Shell, says that it's his favorite Ghibli film. When he's asked, admittedly this is in the mid-90s, he says this, so that's before Princess Mononoke,
et cetera. Now it's when Mario was there.
Exactly. But back then he says, Castle in the Sky is the one. But is it the one for you, Jake?
It's a one. All right, yeah, we should probably delve into it.
Yeah.
Should we see what I made of this?
Let's see what you made of it.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So Jake, at this point, this is the earliest we've gone with Miyazaki. You've seen maybe the 5 or 6 films he makes after this, the films that make his name, the films that set the foundations, the style and tone of Ghibli. This is the earliest we're going in this miniseries. Do you recognize things here? Are things that are even new to you even now?
Well, we're starting with clouds and a plane. So initially, I've got that lovely comfort of knowing I'm in a Miyazaki film with some of my highlights.
Yeah.
But there are certainly elements that I pick up on here that I feel like just get dropped after this film. There are beliefs, there are visuals, there's even some tonal stuff that we would never really see resurrected. But there's also lots of ideas that we will never see dropped from a Miyazaki film, that they're clear are just part of his DNA from the very start.
Mm.
And it's interesting thinking about it from a contextual point of view, that if this is the commercial prospect that it needs to be to create the studio, how much of it is him aligning to his personal beliefs and how much is it him saying, how much is it him wanting to create a commercial product.
Mm-hmm. And so where do we start with this then? Maybe we should start with these aerial sequences and flight. And this is pre-Porco Rosso. We've discussed that already. We also have Kiki's Delivery Service in the film that comes a couple of films after this where flight is a key component.
Yeah, and we open right in the action as well. And I think, as you're saying about this being a boy's own adventure type film, you latch onto it straight away, and you're really thrown in, and it's quite thrilling at the start. Compare this to Totoro or Spirited Away, where you're almost drip-fed the adventure, where you have to earn it, first of all, going through the hardship and the kind of relaxing opening of those films, whereas this doesn't have that at all. We've got a girl falling out of the sky and a magic crystal and sky pirates and airships and planes and flapters. And that was perhaps not what I was expecting. But I was also watching this film with friends, with a bowl of popcorn projected, and I felt like, unlike a lot of his other films, that felt like the right environment, and very quickly I could recognize that.
An entertaining opening, like a pre-credits sequence like you'd find in an Indiana Jones movie. It's fascinating comparing the opening to this film with the opening to Porco Rosso, which is quite similar, an opening sortie, an opening adventure. But where Porco Rosso almost undercuts all of the stakes and violence, this film is still quite violent and scary. This film has so many guns in it. Going back and rewatching this after watching all the films we have for this series so far, it has so many of the trappings of action cinema.
Yeah. But it riffs on those as well. Like, you've got there's a brilliant scene of two guys who are flexing their chests at each other that is hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
And it's taking the mick out of the macho bravado that we're seeing perhaps in Western 80s action films at the time, of just guys wanting to be as big and as buff as possible.
I love that sequence. So that's a bit later on when the military goons and the sky pirates come to the mining town, and the big beardy bloke decides to stand up to them, and they just puff up their chests. Miyazaki said that he just let the character animators go free with that one. And it shows that he's really experimenting with character animation in this. There doesn't feel like there's a stock studio style guide yet.
No, and I don't know whether you would be able to help me on this. I felt like the backgrounds, in a way, had this depth to them that perhaps I wouldn't see, that almost in a way the later films would be more detailed, but flatter. Particularly when later in the film we get to Laputa, it feels like it's just endless and it just drifts into the background.
They're beautiful painted backgrounds, aren't they? For me, it's more that the character designs, particularly their faces, look like they're more from the previous generation of anime, more in the direction of Astro Boy, or thinking about Speed Racer, the sort of 60s, 70s anime faces, rather than what we'd come to believe to be distinctly Miyazaki faces. I don't know if you noticed
definitely
that as well.
These aren't the faces that we're familiar with.
There are some that point the way. I think that Mama, the leader of the Sky Pirates, is there, and there's the engineer on the ship as well, with the big mustache, who looks like the, you know, the guys from Spirited Away as well.
I did wonder whether Matt Groening, before making Futurama, had seen this, because the character of Mom is very similar to the character of Mama in this. Yeah, going right into this, we get a lot of stuff that is almost a shock to me in a really nice way, like the Joe Hisaishi score. You had told me in the past that this is going to be different, but it's great. And you've got that sweeping orchestra feeling that we recognize from the later films, but you've got this lovely synthy keyboard stuff going on as well, which wouldn't really resurrect again.
Like driving synth riffs, which... I think visually this film inspires a lot of video games, but I think musically it does as well. It makes me think of a lot of Nintendo, Super Nintendo, Mega Drive era scores, particularly for fantasy adventures, those driving themes. It's just fantastic. And the fact that it has those both side by side, two separate almost orchestrations, one for orchestra, one for synthesizer, it works so well in this. But let's talk about that central locale we have in all of his films, it seems, Porco Rosso, Key's Lyric Service, Spirited Away, these central locations, and we have this mining town, which is like nothing else.
Yeah, and thinking about the mining towns of Wales and him seeing that and seeing this idea of a town without its industry or left just disappearing. What I really liked about this, we've spoken before about his passion for a hard day's work and how important that can actually be for a person. And not only do we see the importance of this mining town, but the town itself is literally within the cliffs. Mm. It's within the rocks. And it's saying that the industry and the people and the work and the landscape are all one thing.
Mm-hmm.
So learning that about his experiences totally kind of formed it all together for me.
This is a film for me, I really respect its reputation, but this is a film for me which has full 30-minute sequences that are perfect. And maybe it goes away from that at times. But I think the first 40 minutes, 30 minutes, where you're in that town, you have the morning sequence where Pazu gets up,
he blows the trumpet,
he makes some nice breakfast.
Well, I think you mentioned about the start being this almost like a pre-credits, and it feels like that is where we take pause for a moment to assess the situation. And because it is so energetic at the start, you just need that reprieve for a moment and to get a sense of the landscape. And it's just lovely.
And it reminds me of things we've talked about before, where sometimes these films are just the best. They're best when you're hanging out in an environment and you're marinating with these people and these communities.
This is Chihiro sitting on the edge of the bathhouse.
Exactly, or it's the Howlsby and Castle family hanging out with some laundry on a hillside. That's exactly what this is.
But then we get an amazing minecart chase.
Which is very Spielberg,
yes,
isn't it?
Totally.
It's very Temple of Doom. Mm. He loves a train, but it's the train chase.
Amongst all of that, with that energy, there's a few too many explosions for me. You mentioned about the guns and the violence, and that it does just get a bit hectic. This is the closest Miyazaki will get to a Michael Bay film, I feel.
You've come across the meme, haven't you? And I'm sure many of our listeners have of the Miyazaki looking grumpy saying anime was a mistake, which is taken from the documentary, The Kingdom of Dreams and Madness. I think he's talking about anime as the construct of what is taken from this film, of quite accessible adventure explosions sort of explosion filled sort of film, rather than the anime of ideas and wisdom and spiritualism that he would then go on to create. And he almost regrets making a film like this, Nausicaa, and the films before that, that created an industry around those films, created an expectation of what those films were and who they were playing towards. Mm. An infantilization, I think he sees it as. When he's very glum about anime, I think that's what he talks about. And that's what this is. There's a whole middle sequence where the first robot wakes up. And the robot creations are absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, like this, he's got the personality of a no-face in a way, but mixed with the Iron Giant. It's lovely.
But that has to be... It feels that at this stage in his career, he can only talk in extremes. So the tragedy of the robot is that they're these lonely, soulful beings, but their only response when provoked is to destroy. And the castle in the sky is this place of wonder and untold technology, but it's also a super weapon and needs to be taken away from human beings, because human beings, when given technology like Prometheus, will just burn everything to the ground. And I think as he goes on, that wisdom comes through a little bit more in his work. And here it's a bit blunt. It goes through extremes.
Yeah.
There is a 90-minute version of this film, which I think would be perfect if you cut out a lot of that action, a lot of the antagonistic forces of Muska.
Yeah.
Again, a very broad villain figure.
Yeah. Along with Sheeta as well, two characters that are almost essential to the plot, but aren't given as much time to really make you feel the weight of them and their importance.
Mm-hmm.
Sheeta starts the film, mm-hmm. and you feel like from that beginning how important she's going to be, but then it becomes Pazuzu's film. And I think the villain plot is unleashed a little bit late, and he's a bit twirling mustache as
so
well.
Is, isn't he?
And there's not really any balance in the stakes of this as well. Thinking about how he would go on to really try to erase any binary between antagonist and protagonist, here we're not getting that at all.
You have like the ultimate villain move of what does he do? He shoots off her ponytail.
Mm.
It's like he could have shot her in the face, but no. It's such a Western bad guy move, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I feel that the other sequence that I think is incredible is when they first reach the island in the sky, and it's just the two of them in this very quiet space. It reminds me of parts of the Legend of Zelda games where you're just in an expansive, ruined, abandoned area, discovering the wildlife and the ruins of a former civilization there. But also, I think that captures their relationship when they're still tied together from when they were in the glider, and they're rolling about and giggling in the grass. And
yeah.
Then you see the robot that's tending to the birds of the island. It's quite beautiful,
yeah.
Isn't it?
I really love that. And the glider is a really neat bit of. That's how they get to Laputa, that it's not it's not necessarily a mechanical construction. A glider has no engine, it has no moving parts. Ultimately, they have to rely on nature to let them get to Laputa.
Mm-hmm.
They have to ride the wind.
So to wrap up, do you think that this final twist towards being an eco-fable, does it land where the moral of the story is just literally said between characters, where it's said to Muska, your weapons may be powerful, but you can't survive separate from the Earth? Does it feel a bit earnest? Does it work?
I like what it stands for, but I don't necessarily like it in execution.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's what we'd see in Princess Mononoke or Howl's Moving Castle. It's that earlier section, the Totoro's, where he manages to stick that landing without necessarily directly addressing it at all. And those films are wonderful for it, where you are not really directly being addressed. And this is really on the nose in terms of its delivery at the end, but also with its characters as well, and it's all quite brash.
Mm. Well, it's as you say, he nails it so perfectly in Kiki's Delivery Service, where you have a young girl on her broom flying with the flotilla of birds.
Yeah. Also, I would like to mention that I think maybe slightly tinfoil hat, but Kiki's outfit in Kiki's Delivery Service is the same as Sheeta's in Castle in the Sky, or very similar. And I think that's Miyazaki addressing the fact that Shita is an underwritten character.
It's like writing previous wrongs.
Yes.
Okay. Well, now let's park that there. Let's see if, therefore, Castle in the Sky may be up there with Kiki's Literary Service in our estimations.
Let's do it. Let's put this film on the leaderboard.
In the past, this section has been called the leaderboard, but responding to some listener feedback, I think let's broaden this out. This can be the leaderboard and Jacob's Ladder in one go, because really by this point, you've watched over a dozen of these films. I'm just as interested, and listeners are just as interested, to hear where these films land for you.
Okay, I'm prepared.
And maybe now that we have 15, 16 and onwards films to put into this list, let's break this out into tiers, rather than recounting the entire countdown every time. But Jake, you go first. Where does this land for you?
So I really enjoyed this film. It didn't give me the emotional punch that sometimes I want from these films, or that tightness of storytelling that comes with my favourites of Totoro and Porco Rosso. It does kind of sprawl away a bit much. So I'm going to put this lower mid-tier. So for me, that's ranking just above Princess Mononoke and below Spirited Away.
Above Princess Mononoke, Jake?
Yeah, yeah. You know my feelings on that film. Sorry, listeners, again.
I know. But then every day I wake up and think that you're going to come to the error of your ways.
Okay, where does it land for you?
Well, for me, this is mid-tier, solid mid-tier. As I said, I completely respect this film's standing in the history of anime. I know that for many older listeners and older fans, this was the first film they saw. This was one of those films that somehow sneaked onto British television in the early 90s, mid-90s on ITV with a really old, strange dub. But much of what I enjoy about this film is done better and in longer form, in more complete form, in other films. Mm-hmm. So I think that this lands below the perfect top tier for me, which we talked about in the past, including Whisper in the Heart, Totoro, Grave of the Fireflies, Mononoke, Kiki's, Porco Rosso. This lands in between Spirited Away and Ponyo, where below this is films which have some fantastic ideas and sequences, but just don't quite stick the landing, as you say. So mid tier for me. But I realise that some people have this up there as one of their favourites.
Yeah, and I can totally see why as well. There are some of these where that idea doesn't click, but this one I can see all those elements and maybe they just weren't clicking into place.
And now, having discussed this, I really can't wait to see what you think about Nausicaa, which we'll come to maybe next series.
Yeah.
Because that's one that, again, it feels like you're not a fan of the epic adventures. Mm. That is the most epic.
Okay. And well, actually, I'm really fascinated to see how this one is going to line up with our next episode. We're going from the first to the last.
Well, the last one currently, of course, we're going to The Wind Rises next, which to date is Miyazaki's last released film. Of course, he has one coming out, 2020, 2021. Do you know anything about The Wind Rises, Jake?
I just know it's about planes.
And you're pumped about the planes.
I'm very excited about the planes.
I'm very excited for you to see this. This is a film that I saw at the Venice Film Festival. And the first time I saw Ghibli in a premiere context, I was so excited when I got the chance to see this. I can't wait to discuss it with you, Jake.
Yeah. Well, we hope you've enjoyed your time in the Ghibliotech. Next week, as we said, it's The Wind Rises. Until then, you can keep up to date with Michael on Twitter at Michael J. Leader.
And you can follow Jake on Twitter at Jake H. Cunningham.
Ghibliotech is a Little Dot Studios production. Our music is made by Anthony Ng, our artwork is by Sophie Moe, and Lister Russell makes us sound good. The show is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Harold McShill, and Steph Watts. That's me.
Hi everyone, thank you for sticking with us through the credits. Today's nugget is all about the power of one word. We'd spoken earlier about how Castle in the Sky's popularity over the years has been sustained by repeat screenings on television in Japan. Well, in August 2013, a TV screening of Castle in the Sky helped break the world record for most tweets in 1 second. This is part of a recent tradition where viewers would tweet the word "bulse" when the magic phrase is uttered at the end of the film. During that screening, there was a spike of over 140,000 tweets in 1 second when the BALS line came around. To put that in context, Twitter at that point reported an average of just under 6,000 tweets a second in general. So here's a reminder, if you even needed one, don't underestimate the power of Studio Ghibli.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.